From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. For the rest of this hour, tune deafness or tone deafness. That's people who can't tell this. From this. Or what about this? From this. Now, if you couldn't tell the difference, give us a call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, because those are very distinguishable to about 90% or so of our audience. And if you're in that 10%, we would like to hear from you. And so would my next guest, because he's doing research on this very topic. And that's Dr. Alan Brown. He's the chief of the language section in the voice, speech, and language branch at the National Institute on Deafness and Other Communication Disorders. That's a part of the National Institutes of Health. And the reason he's coming on the program is he's just finished or he's just published a paper in the journal PLOS One that talks about people who say they can't hear the wrong notes in those two pieces we just played. But if you look at what their brains are doing, it's not so clear. So give us a call, even if you did hear the difference, and we'll talk about this. It's 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let me welcome you to the program, Dr. Brown.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So did I say that right? Is it about 90% of the people who hear those tones will say, oh, yes, I the first one is completely right and the second one is completely wrong?
Probably even a little bit more.
Right. But there are people who will say, problem? What problem?
Right. Exactly. These people just do not appreciate music. And it's fairly prevalent, not quite 10%, but we think between 2 and 4% of the population just can't do this.
And so why were you interested in studying this population?
Well, we're interested in what the brain abnormalities are that underlie these symptoms. We really were motivated by the fact that there's a study of these subjects, genetic study of these subjects, in order to identify the genetic variants that underlie this condition. Mm-hmm. And we use some of these electrophysiological measures to provide quantitative phenotypic markers, that is, ways of quantitatively diagnosing the condition, which is necessary for reliable genetic studies.
So you say this is an abnormality. I mean, you say that not wanting to put a qualitative word on it, but a normal person should be able to hear these errors clearly.
Yeah. Well, the inability to perform on the test we use, the distorted tunes test, to identify these subjects is fairly continuous. So it's not that there's a group of subjects who can and a group who can't, but there's a fairly continuous gradation of people from those that absolutely get everything right to those that can't discriminate at all.
So what are you seeing in the brains of people who say, nope, can't tell a single difference, that tells you that maybe there is some difference that's being perceived?
Well, we used, as I said, these electrophysiological methods, EEG, event-related potentials, to look at two markers of what's called change detection. That is the ability or the brain's response to obvious differences in stimuli that are expected, that deviate from expectations. The two that we looked at are called the mismatch negativity, which is generated about 200 milliseconds after the deviant note is presented to the subject, and the P300, which is generated a little bit later. They're generated in different portions of the brain, but both are very unambiguous responses to change, to violation of expectation, and have been seen to be generated by these sorts of deviations in melodic structure in normal subjects. And we expected both of them to be abnormal in the tune deaf subjects.
Right, and they weren't.
Well, the mismatch negativity was. The earlier one, about 200 milliseconds, that's generated in the early auditory cortices, was not present. It was clearly present in control subjects, absent in tune-deaf subjects. That didn't surprise us. But we were sort of floored by the fact that the later response, the P300, which was very robust in control subjects in response to the deviations, was just as robust in the tune-deaf population.
So that's the question. What does it mean that the brains of these tune deaf people were responding almost identically to the wrong notes as the brains of people who clearly heard the errors, and yet one group says, yes, I heard it, and the other group says, no, I didn't.
Well, it means, just as you've said, that they are clearly processing the differences. They're clearly discriminating. The brain is discriminating the differences between the deviant and the normal ending of these tunes. But they are absolutely unaware. So they're processing these differences outside of conscious awareness. They know the differences at some level, but they're unaware of them.
Okay. Well, let's take a call now. And some listeners already rose to the challenge of telling us that they were having trouble discriminating the differences. And we have John from Minnetonka, Minnesota. John, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Joe. I laughed out loud when I heard the two songs because I said to myself, they're playing the same one over, trying to trick us.
Well, Dr. Brown, is that the kind of response that people who have this condition frequently have?
Absolutely, yeah. So, those that are more severely affected, and it sounds like your caller may be.
Yeah.
Well, I could tell that within each song, the different notes.
Right.
But when you played the first and the second, there was no difference at all.
Wow. So, John, do you like to turn on the radio and listen to music?
I love music.
Uh huh. So
I listen to music all the time.
So what's your favorite song?
I couldn't match the note when I sang it, mm-hmm. but to listen to it was fine.
Yeah, and do you have a style of music or a favorite piece of music?
I like almost anything except gospel music. For some reason, doesn't do much for me.
So in other words, Yankee Doodle is not. I mean, you've heard that before. That wasn't a surprise to you.
No, that wasn't a surprise.
But you could identify it as Yankee Doodle.
Yes, absolutely.
Huh. So, I mean, what are we to make of this, Dr. Brown? I mean, I just think it's so interesting that there's clearly something that's normal and something that's sort of off normal or maybe you just don't have a good radio. I guess that's a possibility.
Oh, no, did you change key or something? Is that what happened?
To tell them the nature of the errors, Dr.
Well, the
Brown.
Errors in what you played are from the distorted tunes test.
Mm-hmm.
Those are a little more varied and a little more dramatic than the errors we used in our study, which were deviations about one or two semitones only at the end of the melody. But your caller is a little bit atypical in that most of these subjects don't really appreciate music. They don't tell us that they enjoy listening to music. So that's a little atypical. But what your caller said that's important is that he heard all of the stimuli, all of the notes, and that's an important part of this condition, that auditory processing, primary auditory processing, is intact. It's the inability to recognize melodic structure that is the problem in these cases.
Well, John, I'll keep you one more second because I'm just curious. Have you ever? I mean, are there any parts of your life like I don't know? Is there any time when you think, oh gosh, there's things that I can't do that other people seem to do easily, or are you just
absolutely
like what?
I'll never forget holding my infant son and singing to him at maybe 6 months and having him reach up and grab my mouth to cough.
Well, clearly, if it's genetic, it's not a deeply penetrant gene in your family.
It must not be, because you could tell I was not singing correctly.
Yeah. All right. Well, John, thanks very much for your call.
Thanks, Joe.
A really interesting issue. And we have another person who also claims to be in this boat. And let's go to Pam from St. Paul, Minnesota. Pam, you say that you couldn't hear the differences in the tunes either?
Oh, no. I could tell they were similar, but I could not tell. You know, I mean, I couldn't tell any vast difference, but I have Meniere's disease, which is an inner ear disease, and so I'm totally deaf in my right ear, but my hearing comes and goes, and right now it's really, really good. But a year ago, it wasn't so good, and if you would have played that, it would have been absolutely, I couldn't have told any type of difference. And what's frustrating for me is, like, during that time when my hearing is so bad, I will be in church, and I can't tell anything, any tones. And I could relate to that guy about that six-month-old, only it's my 16-year-old. When I'm in church, they absolutely will not let me sing because I'm so out of tune.
Oh, Pam, I'm sorry to hear that. Well, thanks very much for your call. I want to ask, Dr. Braun, is it the subjects that you were looking at, they were mostly people who, like our first caller, he had good hearing.
Right. Yeah, we made sure that the patients, the subjects we studied had no problems with hearing. And clearly, the woman who just called, Meniere's disease, presents a different picture, and maybe the deafness associated with Meniere's that causes her problems.
I got it. Let's listen to, actually, we have another caller here. Steve from Nottingham, New Hampshire, also says he had trouble discriminating the tones. Steve, you couldn't tell the difference between those two.
Hey, I'm getting really upset because I've been called. You said I'm abnormal. I want to know about this because, in synagogue, my kids, and no one wants me to sing. In fact, they asked me to sing Far, Far Away.
Mm-hmm.
But I do love folk music. I do love music, but I could not tell the difference. Mm. And folk both sounded pretty damn good to me.
Mm-hmm. I think abnormal may be a little strong.
Yeah,
abnormal in the sense of, we're all abnormal, Steve.
Oh,
it's just in different ways.
tell
me a little more about that, Dr. Braun. What is this continuum that you're talking about?
Well, if you just mark the scores that subjects have on this test, the distorted tunes test, it goes from 100% down to 50, down to chance, as though they were selecting at random, in a fairly linear fashion. So some of the population is modestly impaired, some is very impaired, and some is unimpaired.
And you said you're beginning to use these data to help look for genes. Have there been genes that seem to be associated? In other words, is there a physical difference in the brains between people?
Well, there's nothing that we can see, and we certainly can use the data we've generated as a phenotyping tool, but we are dependent upon sort of classical methods of gene mapping to try to identify what the gene or genes are that are abnormal, what the gene products are, whether they're structural or regulatory proteins, which will give us a clue on as to what is going on in these brains.
We're talking with Dr. Alan R. Braun about a new paper he's written about what's going on in the brains of tune-deaf people. He's at the National Institute on Deafness and Other Communication Disorders. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm curious, you know, one of the things when I read this paper that it made me think about was there are other phenomena where, like in other sensory systems,
right,
where people will, you know, people who are definitely blind, you can flash things in front of them and you say to them, well, did you see anything? And they say, no, we didn't see anything. Well, think of the first word that comes into your mind and you've just flashed a picture of a shoe at them and they'll say, well, shoe, you know. Is that a similar, they call it blind sight,
that's
I think.
Blind sight.
Yeah, is
right.
That a similar phenomenon?
Well, it's not similar in one important way, and that is that there is structural damage to the brain in those subjects.
Mm-hmm.
So those subjects have damage to the primary visual cortex, V1, usually unilaterally, so you can test things in both visual hemi fields. And as you said, you can ask them force them to make a choice, and they're often right, sometimes up to 90% correct, but they are absolutely unaware. So it's the same phenomenon, but it's based on a structural lesion in the brain, which makes it difficult to study these conditions because there's variability across subjects. What's interesting to us about tune deafness is that it occurs in an otherwise intact brain that is very common, 2-4% of the population. And if we really are able to say that these subjects are perceiving without being aware of these auditory stimuli, these auditory deviations, it allows us, because it's a very heritable condition, to use the tools of genetic research to study conscious awareness.
Interesting. Let's take one more call now and go to Piero in Montpelier, Vermont. Piero, welcome to the program.
Hi, this is a great conversation for me because I'm a conductor and I work with singers all the time. And I've definitely had experiences where they don't know if what they're singing is right or wrong.
Uh-huh.
But I'm wondering if you've had the experience, I definitely see progress. Like, you know, I might be working with a singer in the beginning of the season and they'll be singing a little out of tune or they'll be singing wrong notes, but by the end it improves.
Interesting question. Now, I know you're not trying to train these subjects, Dr. Brown, but is it possible that if you give them the test 100 times, they'll do poorly, but 500 times they'll get better at it? Or if you give them feedback about it each time?
If you give them the distorted tunes test, they're reliably going to perform the same. It's a very reliable instrument, so they're going to perform the same each time you give it to them. But that doesn't really get at the issue of training. Nobody's tried that, and it's an interesting point. If they can process these things outside of conscious awareness, then perhaps they can be trained to recognize them, incorporate them into consciousness, and improve. I just don't know.
That's an interesting point, Piero. Thanks very much for that call.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, I'm wondering, though, that's an interesting point, too. Is there any example where these kinds of unconscious or subconscious brain phenomenon are brought into consciousness through training, or can you think of one?
Not in the conditions we just talked about, blindsight or deaf hearing or prosopagnosia. There certainly are instances in which things that are processed outside of conscious awareness have priming effects on things that occur subsequently. So it's not out of the question.
Mm-hmm. And are you extending this study, or was this simply in the development of these testing purposes for
We're extending it now because of what we found. We expected just to find the absence of these two markers and then use them. But in fact, we found this interesting phenomenon, and we want now to use functional imaging methods such as MRI in conjunction with EEG to get a better handle on where in the brain these processes are occurring.
So are you recruiting subjects?
Not currently, but we probably will be over the next several
weeks. All right. Well, there are links on our website to your website, so people can keep in touch and find out what's happening. Anyway, thank you very much for joining me this hour, Dr.
My
Brown.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Alan Brown is the chief of the language section in the voice, speech, and language branch of the National Institute on Deafness and Other Communication Disorders. That's a part of the NIH. This program is produced by Karen Vergoth and senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Bergquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Schumann Ma is our Metcalf fellow. Our intern is Christopher Intagliata. We also had help in Second Life from Lynn Collins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. If you'd like to write to us, please send us your letters to Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. You can email us. The address is scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to today's program. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online or take them with you as a podcast. For NPR News in Washington, I'm Joe Palca.